You're listening to Catholic Chicago on WNDZ 750 AM. During the next hour, the Archdiocese of Chicago brings you programs about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Welcome to Catholic Chicago.
Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference of Illinois, and thanks for listening and joining our program here this morning on this kind of overcast fall morning and the day after a beautiful Bears game at Soldier Field yesterday. It's kind of interesting. Our first guest is from Wisconsin. I didn't know that when we booked this, but oh well, we'll forge ahead. So let's go over the lineup for today's program. We got four guests, so we have to plow through this pretty quickly, this intro. We're going to talk a little bit about assisted suicide here at the outset of the program. Our first guest is Barbara Lyons. She's with the Patients' Rights Action Fund. She's going to talk about a report that came out recently from the National Council on Disabilities, and it affects the issue of assisted suicide. Then we're going to jump to talk about some of the cases that have been pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Jim Gioli, who's an attorney with Burke, Warner, McKay, and Saratella, he's going to join us to talk about what happened with those two cases involving Title VII and sexual orientation and rights of LGBTQ individuals, and what his take on that those hearings were. I think that was last week, the hearings were. Then we're going to talk a little bit about some issues pending in Springfield coming up. The veto session will begin next week, and there's some big issues pending. We're going to talk to Brad Cole of the Illinois Municipal League. He's going to talk about probably one of the bigger issues pending for the 6 days, which is a proposal put forth by Governor Pritzker and how to begin to address some of the pension issues we have in our state. Brad's going to talk to us about that. And then finally, we're going to be joined by Rebecca Ansel, who's a journalist, a good writer with the organization called the Capital News Illinois. And she's going to talk about other issues pending in the upcoming veto session, issues that we've been reading about. Perhaps she has a take on what's going to happen with some of the proposed changes to the marijuana laws and to the marijuana legislation that passed last year, amongst other things. Always something to talk about. And with that said, let's plow ahead with our first guest, and hopefully we have on the line with us Barbara Lyons of the Patients' Rights Action Fund. Barbara, are you with us?
Good morning, Bob. It's Barbara Lyons checking in from Lambeau Field. It's wonderful to be with you today.
It's back. I know. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's pretty much over, I think. Let's just give the Packers the NFC North title, and let's just kind of move on with things. Things are back to normal,
like
right?
I like that attitude. I know.
It's so painful. But, hey, that's who knows? Anything's possible. Miracles,
anything's possible.
We're a people of hope, right?
Right, there you go.
Whoa, we're going to need a lot of it. Let's talk a little bit about a recent report that came out from a group called the National Council on Disabilities. And in terms of context, it's probably a good idea to explain to listeners. Your group, the Patients' Rights Action Fund, has been very involved, not only in Illinois, perhaps, but you've been all over the country articulating the reasons against physician-assisted suicide everywhere. And you're coming to Illinois soon, helping us convene a group of people to help get ready for legislation. And we think that there could be some legislation next year or the year after. There's been some media reports. So unfortunately, it looks like this demonic proposal is coming to Illinois. So we got to fight this. But In preparation for that, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are in the report. The association came out, it was recently, the National Council on Disabilities, and talked about assisted suicide. And what they found was that some of the reasons that the proponents give for assisted suicide does not exactly line up where the National Association on Disabilities is at. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we're very thrilled about this report. Mm-hmm. We believe it's a groundbreaking report that will have a substantial impact on the debate both in Congress and across the country, And especially in states like Illinois, where we are very concerned that efforts are being generated to legalize assisted suicide in your great state. And that would be a forewarning to other Midwestern states that it could spread to their states, too. So they certainly proponents of assisted suicide would love to have a foothold in the Midwest, and Illinois looks like where they're headed. Although Minnesota is very active, too, so we're watching those states very, very closely. Getting back to the report, this report from the National Council on Disability is groundbreaking in that it lays bare the issues for, again, the public and for Congress, for state legislatures, as to why assisted suicide laws are detrimental to people with disabilities. And it focuses pretty much on that aspect of the assisted suicide laws, but I think there are lessons within the report for just the general population at large. And I think it's important to note that people who are terminally ill, many of them fall into the category of being people who have disabilities simply because they're not able to care for themselves. They need a caretaker. They need assistance. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of fall into that same category, people with disabilities. So it has a wide-ranging impact on several classes of people. I think one of the key bottom line facets of this report is a quote from Diane Coleman, who is the president of Not Dead Yet, a major disability group. She says, legalizing assisted suicide means that some people who say they want to die will receive suicide intervention, while others will receive suicide assistance. The difference between these two groups of people will be their health or disability status, leading to a two-tiered system that results in death to the socially devalued group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're looking at here. We have essentially a smaller group of people that are agitating for the assisted suicide laws. They want the ability to control their death, to control the end of their life, to have these pills available whether they take them or not, so that they can feel comforted knowing that there's something there that will help them. But the problem with that approach is that by acceding to the wishes of this smaller group of people, and it is a small group of people who actually ask for prescription of these lethal drugs, as we've seen in the states where it is legalized. It's not like a massive population shift to we want these drugs. It's a small group of people. By acceding to their wishes, essentially what we're doing is we're laying open a larger group of people to the potential abuses of having these pills available and all the inherent risks that go along with having lethal drugs essentially in the home and in the local communities.
One of the things the report does get at is the proponents always cite pain relief as one of the needs to pass this legislation. Yet the report says that really what people with disabilities need are additional services and supports. That's what they need. They don't need this legislation that purports to relieve pain.
That's an important part of the National Council on Disability report, but also we have to look at the reports that come out of Oregon and Washington. And we do have some data coming out of those states where it is legal. We're finding is that as subsequent states pass laws, they're sort of diminishing the amount of information that has to be gathered.
Sure.
And even with the Oregon and Washington reports, they're not, they have flaws in the data collection and what they do with the records and so on, but at least we have some indication of what's going on. And what we found in both of those states is that relief of pain is far down the list of reasons why people request lethal drugs. At the top of the list are things like they don't want to be a burden to others, they don't want to be living in an impaired state, they want control over their bodily functions, they want to participate in society. Those are all social reasons, not medical reasons, for wanting lethal drugs. So while it's being sold very well, I would say, by the proponents of assisted suicide as something that people need to relieve their pain, and it's an emotion that grabs people emotionally. Oh, my gosh, I don't want to be in pain.
Sure.
I don't want my relatives to be in pain. And everybody has a story about a relative that had what they believe was a death of suffering.
Yep.
That included a lot of suffering. So while they sell it very effectively on that emotional aspect of the issue, in reality, it's not why people are asking for lethal drugs to be prescribed to them. And, of course, we have all these, you know, wild instances of reports of people having, you know, death parties where they invite all their friends.
Right.
And, there are some of those going on. And essentially what it does, and it gets back to Diane Coleman's quote, is that it essentially make suicide look like a good thing. And that sends a terrible message to some of the most vulnerable groups to suicide, and that's veterans, young people, and so on. So it glamorizes a suicide at a time when we have a terrible suicide problem in our general population.
I wanted to mention that. I'm glad you just did. Because there is an alarming issue with suicide in this country. I can't do these numbers off the top of my head, but last time I looked at this, which was some time ago, there were roughly 14,000 homicides, which means one person taking the life of another through a number of different means. There were about 14,000 of those, and I think the last data I saw, there were about 41,000 suicides in the United States, and I think the ratio is about 3 to 1 in terms of the number of people who take their own lives compared to those who kill another person. I mean, neither are moral and neither are worthy of anything, but it's just alarming. Then the suicide is a huge problem in this country, and I can't help but wonder how these sort of legislative proposals, it's only going to exacerbate that problem.
Well, we've seen some evidence of that in states like Oregon, which has had assisted suicide for 20 years, and what we find there is that their suicide rate in the general population is some 40 to 49% higher than the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And I think it's in Oregon that 16% of veterans, 16% of all veteran suicides occur in the state of Oregon. Now, why there? Oregon's a pretty small state, and when you have a high number of suicides going on there with veterans, it tells you that there is a message, what we call suicide contagion. In other words,
yep,
if suicide is a good, it catches on and it becomes something that's glamorized and it looks more acceptable than something that we know is horrifying for particularly the surviving family members who have a member who has committed suicide. So suicide contagion is one of the aspects, but there are all kinds of key findings in this National Council of Disability report that talk about, you know, the proponents always talk about safeguards. Well, first of all, the safeguards are not effective. For example, it doesn't prohibit insurers from saying, I'm not going to cover your life-saving treatment, but I will pay for your assisted suicide pills. They're just so much cheaper. The pills are so much cheaper than the treatment. So that becomes an incentive then, an economic incentive for insurance companies and government agencies to save money if they can essentially say, well, we have something for you that's not necessarily what you want. It's just cheaper for us, and you don't get your life-saving treatment. Everybody, all of your listeners out there, I'm sure, every single one knows someone that was told you have 2 months to live or you have 4 months to live.
Sure.
The prognosis.
Sure.
And yet we're told that these laws that say you can have lethal drugs based on this definition that you're going to die within 6 months.
That's a good point.
Is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. It's just ludicrous. We know that in real life that it doesn't exist. Doctors are not someone who can predict death with that kind of certainty, and if they're honest, they will tell you that they can't do it. You know, when you get to the point where it's like the last few days of life, they can maybe say you're going to die within the next week,
right,
but not 6 months from now.
No, exactly.
Depression. People who are depressed will request the drugs, and there's not adequate protection for people who are depressed in these laws. Again, you could go on and on and on with the types of things that are supposed safeguards. But I think I would also like to point out to your listeners, Bob, is that little by little, proponents of assisted suicide are abandoning the safeguards. Well, you know we have these safeguards, but they're really preventing people from getting their lethal drugs. And examples of that would be in Oregon, where they were going to loosen the already flimsy idea that people are going to self-administer their drugs. And essentially, they were going to pretty much allow injection of the drugs. That bill did not pass, but one that did pass in Oregon, which was one that did shorten the time period. And in other words, the original laws, there was like a waiting period. You would request the drugs, request them again, then there would be a waiting period, and so on. Well, they eliminated the 15-day waiting period in Oregon for certain patients. Minnesota, I love the Minnesota law, and this is, again, a warning to those of us in the Midwest. The proposed Minnesota law that's sitting right in the Minnesota legislature right now, first of all, would allow non-physicians to prescribe the drugs, a physician assistant or someone like that. So they're supposed to determine if the person, someone with that lack of training, is supposed to determine if the patient has capacity to make this decision, to see if they're depressed and so on, and to assess all this and that then they're able to prescribe the drugs. They also have virtually no waiting period in the Minnesota law, so you can make the request and get the prescription on the same day. And here's the best part for those of us in the Midwest. There's no residency requirement, so it means that the Illinoisans and the Wisconsinites can all travel to Minnesota. And, I mean, just imagine, you just go across the border, there's someone there waiting to write your prescription, and there's no waiting period, and you go home in a day, you've got your drugs.
Yeah,
so it's the Minnesota law itself is indicative of where they are going with these laws, and that the safeguards have now become...
They don't want safeguards.
They don't want...
That's where they were 20 years ago to pass
these. They're a hindrance to you getting the drugs. They're a barrier. So now we have to eliminate those. So... again, I think that getting back to this report, it points out some of these deficiencies in the laws that have already passed, and the potential, the potential for people with disabilities to be subject to more coercion and abuse. And I think it's an important piece, an important document for us as we go forward in discussing these issues, again with the general public and with our legislators.
Barbara, that's the music. Thanks so much for cramming as much information as possible into a 14-minute segment. Very good. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this again, unfortunately. Because, as I said, it looks like Illinois is going to have some legislation. But this is a good intro in terms of the arguments against it. If there's anybody out there from a developmental disabilities organization who wants to get involved with this, please contact our office. That number is 312-368-1066. And we're going to be discussing this, I'm sure, in the future. Barbara, thanks so much.
We invite you to watch Catholic Chicago this weekend, featuring a conversation with Cardinal Blaise Cupich and video highlights from across the Archdiocese. Here's host Todd Williamson.
We'll take you to a celebration of unity at the newly formed St. Mother Teresa of Calcutta Parish. Representatives of several parishes across the Archdiocese attend Vision Day, a day that focuses on the spiritual side of Renew My Church. And we'll visit with Father Peter Wojcik and hear his hope and vision for the future of the church here in the Archdiocese of Chicago.
Watch Catholic Chicago Friday at 7 p.m. on Chicago Loop Cable, Channel 25, and Sunday afternoon at 3 on the Comcast Network, Channel 100.
Are you an attorney who's retired or semi-retired from your practice? Catholic Charities welcomes your expertise. Whether it's a dispute with a landlord or being the victim of a scam or an issue regarding family law, clients can feel alone in this complex legal system, especially if they're unable to afford an attorney. Our volunteer attorneys answer our legal advice line, offer one-hour consultation, and conduct legal seminars. They are dedicated to informing and empowering low-income individuals as they navigate civil law issues affecting their lives. Come in when your schedule permits and share your knowledge with grateful clients. To learn more about this rewarding volunteer program, please call 312-948-6821. That's 312-948-6821. Thank you for considering Catholic Charities Legal Assistance Team.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference of Illinois talking about a couple different public policy issues. And we're going to jump to a public policy issue, but it's being discussed now in the judicial branch. And with us to help ferret out some of those issues is Jim Gioli. He is an attorney with Burke, Warren, McKay, and Saratella, and is here to talk a little bit about some action in the Supreme Court. I think that was last week. Jim, you with us?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. So two cases, actually three cases heard last week in front of the U.S. Supreme Court regarding Title VII, which is that section of federal law that prevents discrimination, unjust discrimination, currently based on sex, gender, marital status, some other things. And now it looks like there's a pending cases that would perhaps change that definition a little bit. Do you want to talk a little bit about the two? It's really three cases, but two cases. It's kind of confusing to people. Let's see if we can make this a little simpler.
It's a trio of cases led by a case called Bostock. And two of the cases involved the legal issue of whether or not the prohibition against discrimination on the basis of sex in employment should include sexual orientation. And the third case involves whether that same prohibition against discrimination on the basis of sex in employment should include transgenderism. And it's an interesting argument because the text of the statute obviously says on the basis of sex, meaning mm-hmm. on the basis of being a man or a woman. And the intent of the statute from 1964 was clearly to make sure that primarily women were treated equally with men in the workplace. And, of course, the other way, too, that men would be treated equally with women in the workplace. It never entered anyone's mind that they would be protecting sexual orientation or transgenderism. And, obviously, if that was the proposal, it would have failed in 1964. There have been something like, I don't recall the number, but it's well over, 20 as well, might be 50 times. Bills have been introduced in Congress explicitly to add sexual orientation to the protected classes, and the Congress has rejected those bills every time. I think there are two bills pending now.
Yes.
They're going nowhere. So, the legislature has not done this. And now you have litigants who are trying to get the courts to interpret the statute to include sexual orientation on the ground that the gender of the person is really the basis of the discrimination. The arguments were, I think, last week, and there are, you can listen to them. It's not clear what the court will do. There is some uncertainty because it's not clear where Justice Gorsuch will go with this. You can predict probably four solid conservatives and four solid liberals. We don't know where Roberts and Gorsuch will go, however. So it's unclear what will happen. One of the issues, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Keep going.
I was just going to say, I know that the question that's probably on the minds of listeners to this program would be, what impact would this have on people of faith and on religious organizations? And is there a religious liberty component?
Right.
To it. And if you like, I can just dive into that.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I was going to go two ways. First issue was, I think in the examples that were provided from the plaintiff's behalf, they were making the argument, well, when the act was written in 1964, there was no such thing as like sexual harassment. And clearly the court has read into the Civil Rights Act that's prohibited. So why couldn't this example, i.e. sex/gender, be adopted into that as well? So
yeah, and there is an answer to that. The answer is that sexual harassment was recognized by the court as a form of discrimination, but the court did not change the things that were prohibited. In other words, sexual harassment on the basis of sex,
right.
on the basis
right.
of race, on
right.
the basis of religion.
Right.
They didn't rewrite what was prohibited. They just recognized the form of behavior that was a form of discrimination. The statute always prohibited quote-unquote discrimination. So they just said harassment does discriminate.
Under those existing monikers, titles. Let's talk a little
exactly.
bit about the impact this could have on religious organizations, because one of the concerns with the legislation pending in Congress, at least the one that I think passed the House, called the Equality Act, it does not provide any protection for religious entities. And
correct.
Under the court's jurisprudence, could it go anywhere on that topic?
Well, there's a few established principles that probably provide, kind of the parameters of this. The Civil Rights Act itself has some protection for religious organizations that they can prefer members of their own faith in hiring. The First Amendment religion clauses, along with freedom of association principles, recognize a right of a private organization, and especially a religious organization, to associate with people who espouse mm-hmm. their own values, and not to require them to associate with people who would represent or speak things you know, inimical to the mission of the organization. So, for instance, the Boy Scouts won a case before they changed their policy on sexual orientation that they did not have to have gay or lesbian scout leaders. The Ancient Order of Hibernians won a case involving the right to control who could march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York because their message was of a Catholic Irish message that did not include, you know, same-sex homosexuality. So those principles have protected religious organizations in situations where they have wanted, you know, not to hire or to fire people who were doing things and saying things against the teachings of the religious organization. And while not 100%, the religious organizations have tended to win those cases because they're not forced to keep in-house, you know, a message mm-hmm. against what they teach. Now, what does that mean, however, if, you know, a church that has a teaching against homosexual activity has, a janitor who is a homosexual and wants to not have somebody on staff who is homosexual? I don't know how that comes out in a situation like that because of an argument about whether or not the janitor's orientation really does or does not interfere with the church's message. On the other hand, there's another category that I want to bring up, which is ministers. And I use the word minister because there's something called the ministerial exception. Mm-hmm. Any employee who performs a religious function, delivers a religious message, represents the religious ideals of the organization, they don't have to be an ordained clergy. They could just simply be a spokesperson or somebody important to the mission of the church where they what they really do as their job has a religious component is known as a ministerial employee. And under a Supreme Court case called Hosanna Tabor, a religious organization has the right, the absolute right, to hire, fire, govern, discipline, manage a ministerial employee without any interference from federal law. So it is an exemption or an exception called the ministerial exception to the discrimination law. And so employees cannot bring discrimination cases when they are ministers, and they can be terminated for good reason, bad reason, no reason at all. The Archdiocese of Chicago has a ministerial exception case now pending mm-hmm. in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit mm-hmm. that I'm going to be arguing mm-hmm. on November 5th, which asks the interesting question whether that ministerial exception applies not just to termination, but also to people bringing hostile environment claims.
Right.
So you could fire me because the teaching of the church is against homosexuality, and I'm a minister, and I'm in a same-sex marriage. But if you say something to me hostile mm-hmm. about my same-sex mm-hmm. marriage while I'm on the job, I could still sue you.
Yep.
So
yep.
These cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court are important because if they expand the law, while they're not dealing expressly with religious issues in their cases, they'll be setting a new standard.
Yep.
And obviously litigants who apply the new doctrine in every setting they can, including the religious setting.
So the court has wide latitude on where it goes and what it emphasizes, and it could find, I'm just speculating, it could find in behalf of the plaintiffs, yet reference Hosanna Tabor, and that creates a different set of jurisprudence than we currently have today.
It could. Yeah. I have, there is, unfortunately, a possibility of damning with St. Craze. The court could rule for the plaintiffs and say the reason we are not concerned mm-hmm. about religious organizations is because we have Hosanna Tabor yep. and we know, that we're yep. not going to be forcing the Catholic Church to change its teaching. But that is kind of a Pyrrhic victory because
yeah.
it means that you're now fighting the battle on every... I mean, we already have the ministerial exception.
Yes.
But it would mean that you are now fighting the battle on every other front in the way you conduct, for instance, a Catholic school where you're going to teach the church's teaching on homosexuality and a homosexual teacher is going to say that you're creating a hostile work environment.
Yep. Yep. So you're ceding ground if they find for the plaintiffs at some level. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or, a hostile work environment can be caused by co-employees. So if you have a religious employee at a regular, company, who has religious beliefs about homosexuality, mm-hmm. and they state those beliefs honestly, not necessarily to harm anyone, but because it comes up and they say what they believe, now they are creating a hostile work environment if sexual orientation is a basis for sex discrimination.
Jim, will this decision, when will this come out? Well, I know it can come out at any time, but generally there's two time frames when the Supreme Court releases its decision, and I know one of them is always on June 30th, and I always try to take that day off, and I'm always interrupted by media questions on court cases that we've had in the past. Will this come out in June or for that time frame, or will it come out at a different time frame?
Unless something unusual happens, the end of June is when the court releases decisions, not necessarily on June 30.
Yeah.
But there's a few weeks there where there are decision release dates of cases they've been working on all term. There's no rule about it.
Yeah.
There's no set time. But the best prediction, I think the term ends on June 30.
Yeah.
So the best prediction is that in those last 2 weeks of June, you'll see a decision. Lately, it seems like the more difficult and controversial ones have been saved at the end.
Yep.
So we'll have to see what happens.
I'll make a mental note now not to take off that time for the last week in June, because I got a feeling June 30th, there's a lot of controversial ones. So I've got a feeling this one is going to be probably one of them. Right in the middle of presidential election. Wonderful.
Yep.
Jim,
I'm sure it will not go unnoted.
No. Jim, thanks for taking some time this morning. Very cogent, clear explanation, and I hope listeners have a better understanding of what's at stake with all these cases. This is Bob Gilligan. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're coming back with Brad Cole. Take care. Thanks.
An important weekend is coming up for religious communities here in the Chicago area and across the United States. Hello, I'm Brother Michael Segvich, Religious Retirement Coordinator for the Archdiocese of Chicago, urging you to give generously on the weekend of December 7th and 8th. That's our annual collection for the Retirement Fund for Religious. It's our 32nd annual collection for religious who have ministered for many years with little or no salaries. The collection goes a long way in addressing retirement funding shortages. Religious congregations are better able to ensure that the charism and good works of their orders continue thanks to this collection. Tens of thousands of elderly Catholic sisters, brothers, and religious order priests benefit, and so do their ministries that help our neediest brothers and sisters. So please keep our religious communities in your hearts, minds, and prayers. We thank you for your kindness. May God bless you.
They say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. For artists and Catholic Charities After Supper Visions program, the possibilities are endless as they capture beauty through the lens of a camera. Now in its 18th year, After Supper Visions offers Catholic Charities supper guests the opportunity to learn more about photography and explore their creative talents. Volunteers work with our clients as they learn the basics of photography, share with other artists, and choose prints to be featured in an annual photo exhibit each June. Supporters of the program purchase prints and gifts for their corporate offices, lobbies, and homes. The artists are often told that the caliber of their photos rivals that of any art gallery in the city. See these gorgeous prints and help more artists find out how uplifting the world of photography can be by visiting aftersuppervisions.com or call Maria at 312-655-7758.
You're listening to Catholic Chicago on WNDZ 750 AM. Every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., the Archdiocese of Chicago presents programming about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Thanks for letting us be part of your morning. Now again, Catholic Chicago.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference of Illinois, and thanks for joining our program here this morning. We're talking about a bunch of different issues, but We're going to now make a segue down about 3 hours south of us to Springfield, Illinois, and talking about one of the probably the biggest issue, maybe one of the bigger issues that is going to be pending during the upcoming veto session that will begin next Monday, the 28th of October. And that has to do with a report that recently was released by the governor and a task force. And it has to do with one of the biggest issues facing Illinois, which is what to do with the pension program, pension obligations that we have. And on the line with us to talk about that is going to be a very busy guy. His name is Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. And Brad, are you with us?
Yes, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning. You're going to be a busy guy the next couple of weeks, huh?
Well, yeah, I try to stay busy all the time, but we definitely have a lot going on for this upcoming legislative session.
I know what it's like to have a big issue in veto, and it's intense. It's a lot going on in a couple of days. Brad, the Municipal League is basically, described to listeners, it's the association of towns and municipalities throughout the state of Illinois, correct?
Right. We represent the 1,298 cities, villages, and towns throughout Illinois.
And so I think everybody listening to this, unless you're living in a cave, knows that the state of Illinois has a profound problem in terms of a shortfall that we have for paying mostly public employees. And the numbers are staggering. Everybody, I think, knows that. And so towards that, trying to solve that issue or begin to address it is probably a better description. The governor had a task force, and it released a report recently. And why don't you take it from here, telling listeners, you know, a little bit about what's being proposed and what we're trying to do here.
Well, the issue is that we have, out of those 1,298 communities, there are more than 650 public safety pension funds, and that has created a system where there are considerable inefficiencies and duplication in the administration of these funds. Right now, between police and fire funds, we have about $15 billion in the funds and another $12.5 billion unfunded. And so what the governor put together was a task force to try to address this and figure out how we could reduce the duplication of these 650 different funds, create some economies of scale, and increase the investment returns, because some of these funds have just a few thousand dollars, or maybe a decent-sized fund has a few million dollars, but they're not able to generate the kind of investment returns that will supplement the contributions being made by the employer, which is the taxpayer through their city, and the employee through their payroll. And so by increasing the investment returns, we can supplement those funds and hopefully move it from this $12.5 billion unfunded to something a lot lower. And we think it could generate as much as $1 million a day in additional interest income statewide. That's a couple hundred, $200, $300, maybe even $400 million a year additional revenue.
And so these smaller funds, these are probably very small municipalities in central and southern Illinois that are comprised of just a couple, sometimes just a few employees, where you have an investment manager or two investing those funds on behalf of a very small number of employees, correct?
Well, this represents what they call the downstate public safety pension funds. That's every municipality outside the city of Chicago. So that's suburban communities, central Illinois, southern Illinois, all across the state.
And so I'm trying to understand both sides of this, and outside of the obvious, the opponents of it are going to say that, I mean, what their public policy arguments are, what, that you would not be experiencing the level of savings is that you're projecting? Is that it? Because I'm having a hard time really understanding what I don't understand, outside of, like I said, the obvious, what the objection is from a public policy standpoint.
Well, you have to take logic and reason out of this if you want to understand the opposition.
Yeah.
And the reality is, and there's argument that is, well, we have local control because there are 650 local boards that manage this.
Sure.
That means there are over 3,000 local trustees.
Yeah.
Well, the Illinois Municipal League invented the idea of local control. We're not opposed to that.
Sure.
We promote that.
We
However, it doesn't do any good to have all these boards that aren't able to invest and see these higher returns. So the people who are opposed to it are, frankly, the folks that like the status quo.
Yeah.
It's okay with them. But the municipalities have to keep paying more and more and more, and that only comes from one person, and that's the taxpayer. The other people that are opposed to it are, quite frankly, the people that have profited off of this system, the fund managers, mm-hmm. the people that do the training for all of these trustees. It's mandated state training. I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars at play here, but it's money that's not being preserved and protected into the pension funds. It's money that's being spent or used out in the private sector. And we think the money should stay in the pension funds for the people who earn the pension. We just had a solicitation message about contributing for pensions for charities and on your show just earlier, and how important that is to protect people's pensions. That's what we're trying to do, keep as much money into the funds as possible.
And you say, when you say the $12 million is unfunded, so that means that if everybody were to retire today, the system would be $12 million short. It wouldn't be able to pay almost half of what is owed.
$12 billion.
Billion. I'm sorry, billion. Right.
That's correct. However, state law mandates that all of these funds have to be 90% funded by the year 2040. So by the year 2040, we have to have 90% of the total obligation in the bank.
Yeah,
and that's what we have to. You know, that's what we have to get to.
Yeah, and but to be clear, though, so this does not include Chicago, because Chicago is it critical mass? Is that the reason why? Because it has an extraordinary large number of individuals in the pension, and does it have just one board overseeing that?
Chicago has two separate public safety funds: one for police, one for firefighters. Mm-hmm. They have four different funds total, but they were set up just separately than these. I don't know who invented this system, but no one would ever create a system of this many pension funds again, unless you're one of those entities profiting off of it. And so the city of Chicago is separate from that. They are a part of the overall conversation because they need to be involved in pension reform and possibly consolidation of funds. But this particular proposal that was released 10 days ago by the governor deals just with those suburban and downstate communities. We're going to be addressing the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois and their pension funds in the spring.
Okay. And so what's the intent, as I understand it from reading the press accounts, is that to try to move this during the veto session coming up. Is that the plan?
That is correct. A week from today, they'll be back at the Capitol, and we're hoping to have legislation that can be enacted at that time, because every day that we don't act is lost opportunity for these funds.
And what's your prognosis? You think you're going to be successful? It's a heavy lift for 6 days.
It's a very heavy lift. And, you know, you indicated earlier, we're a people of hope. So
that's right. Exactly.
We're going to have a little bit of hope and a whole lot of faith, but I think it can get done. And we applaud the governor for pushing this, and the different labor organizations that are supporting it, and, of course, all the local elected officials.
I think it's a step in the right direction. Brad, best of luck to you, and it can be done. We've seen bigger things done in 6 days, so anything is possible.
That's right. Thank you.
Brad, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. Very informative. Brad Cole with the Illinois Municipal League. Don't go away, everybody. We're going to talk with Rebecca Anzel. She's a reporter down in Springfield, and she's going to give us the scoop on the other issues that are going to be pending in the upcoming veto session beginning Monday, the 28th of October. This is Bob Gilligan. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Catholic Charities has been working to improve lives and communities for more than 100 years, offering help and hope to people of all races and religions who come to us in need. All are welcome at Catholic Charities as clients, volunteers, donors, and advocates. Catholic Charities is the social service arm of the Catholic Church and the largest Midwest provider of programs and services that strengthen individuals, families, and communities. With support from donors and partners, we provide meals, clothing, housing, counseling, education, and job training. We provide these services with competence and compassion. To learn more or to join us as a donor or volunteer, visit CatholicCharities.net.
A good education paves the way to a bright future. At Catholic Charities, we work to make that education a reality for all children. Head Start is an innovative program for children ages 3 to 5 from low-income families. It combines school readiness goals with parental involvement so children have the tools they need to be successful in school and in life. In the Back of the Yards, Little Village, and Chicago Lawn communities, Catholic Charities offers free Head Start programs, plus early Head Start for children 2 years old. Each location offers a safe, welcoming environment where preschoolers receive a nutritious breakfast, lunch, and snack while participating in a fun and creative curriculum. It is never too early to help children see the benefits of becoming lifelong learners. Get a head start on a bright future by going to catholiccharities.net/childdevelopment or call 312-655-8592. That's 312-655-8592.
Are you passionate about helping others? Do you enjoy shopping? Combine both and become a volunteer at Catholic Charities West Region Food Pantry in Cicero. Opportunities are available in weekday, daytime hours for individuals or groups to stock shelves, be personal shoppers, and more. Shifts are flexible, and we would be grateful to work within your schedule. As a food pantry, we rely heavily on volunteers to be able to keep our pantry open to serve our clients. Often the smallest gestures make the biggest difference in the lives of those in need. Gather your family or group of friends and come join our team. See what a positive experience helping at our West Region Food Pantry can be. To sign up, please visit www.ccofchicagovolunteer.com.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference. Sorry, I was there kind of distracted. Thanks for listening to our program this morning. We're going to talk more about the upcoming veto session in Springfield coming up on the 28th of October. And it's so ironic. They're going to get it out of there right in time for Halloween. It's pretty spooky. With us on the line is Rebecca Anzel. She is a reporter for the Capital News Service. Did I get that right, Rebecca?
Yeah, Capital News, Illinois, but very close.
Capital News, Illinois. I'm doing this from memory. I'm looking for my notes here, and I can't find it. and you cover just about everything down there. So we figured if you cover everything, you know everything, so then you can tell us what's going on. So we were just talking to Brad Cole of the Illinois Municipal League, and so I think we got that one covered. The big issue that they'll be dealing with is this issue on the pension consolidation for the police and firemen. But there's potentially a lot of other things going on. Is that my understanding, or is this going to be another one? We go down there, we turn around, come home.
Yeah, no, it sounds like there's a lot of things that lawmakers are considering, and it sounds like there's a lot of issues for them to discuss for 6 days that they'll be here.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see which ones get over the hump and which ones just don't. And there could be quite a few that don't. I guess it seems like they have to do something on the marijuana legislation that passed last spring. But is that on the imperative category we have to do?
Yeah, there's a lot of, that bill was over 600 pages,
yep.
And they passed it very quickly. So there's a lot of cleanup language that they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to do anything substantive. A lot of people have concerns about there are a lot of words, for instance, that aren't actually defined anywhere.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So, municipalities are kind of confused about, well, for instance, they're allowed to pass laws, ordinances that
prohibit,
that they
right?
can,
yeah.
yeah, that will allow them to regulate it at their level, but sort of what they're allowed to regulate is not defined wholly.
Got it.
So,
yeah.
That's one thing that they're expected to address.
It's probably like the tip of the iceberg on that, because like you said,
yeah.
It's 600 and something pages, and I can just imagine. So there's the marijuana issue, and is gambling, is that on the docket as well, or is it too early to tell on that?
It's come up.
Yeah.
Mayor Lightfoot definitely has brought it up to lawmakers. She had a meeting with some of the Chicago lawmakers. It's something that she wants to be addressed, but she caught the governor allegedly by surprise.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that's something that he sort of pushes lawmakers to address.
Yeah, the gambling issue is interesting because they have I mean, it was widely publicized up here that the tax that was going to be imposed was prohibitively high, in such that no vendor was going to come forth and put up that kind of capital in order for a casino to be constructed. So I think they're left with, I don't know what they're left with. So I know the mayor came up, I think what you were indicating, one was going to be a municipally owned jointly with a private venture, but I guess that's not going to happen now. But they need to do something on that tax, I think, to induce an investor to come forward with such a large sum of capital that's going to be required, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, because we were just talking about marijuana, it's so interesting that you look at how those two laws were drafted differently. The marijuana law, for instance, was drafted in such a way to make it not so prohibitive, and the casino law, it was drafted in such a way to make it almost prohibitively difficult. I guess that's repetitive, but to make it so difficult to do. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So it looks like those two are kind of in the soup, if you will, but I you know, there could be a lot of positioning, a lot of discussion without, it's hard to pass something in 6 days. I think people don't realize that. It's almost got to be a done deal when you walk in the door, because just the time constraints are so restrictive that one little thing goes wrong, well, then you got to change the posting requirements, and then you get into the soup, and sometimes it just kind of falls apart. Is vaping, I've heard a lot about vaping, and then I heard nothing. So I know that was there was a lot of talk about making it illegal, I think. And now that seems to have fallen off the table, but I'm not sure if there is a table, or is it on the table or off the table.
I guess it depends who you ask. If you talk to the health advocates, they'll tell you that they really want to try to loop any sort of vaping or e-cigarette use into the Smoke-Free Illinois Act. So I'm sure if you walk around Chicago, we certainly see it in Springfield. You just walk around, you see people vaping out on the street.
Yep.
You don't often see, or even inside buildings in their cars, you can't see that with cigarettes because of the Smoke-Free Illinois Law Act. So they're trying to loop in vaping with that. So you can't be inside a building and see somebody vaping. They wanted to get that into veto. I don't know if we'll see that. It sounds like a relatively easy fix. You just have to change the definitions around, which shouldn't be too difficult. But then again, we'll see if there's some sort of pushback. I don't know. We'll see. It's a relatively easy thing to legislate, but then, you know, you get into the politics of it. So.
Right, exactly. Anything else out there that you see coming up?
If you just want to hop back onto marijuana, one of the things that has been, I think, a little misreported is, I guess it depends who you ask. The idea of sort of like weed cafes has been brought out. It's been reported. But again, if you ask health advocates, they'll tell you that the legislation has never allowed for weed cafes to be a thing. That the Smoke-Free Illinois Act was referenced in the marijuana law twice, but that it was never intended to allow for the smoking of marijuana inside of buildings. And so if a trailer bill, and it's expected that will come up, if a trailer bill comes up that's intended to be fixed, so you can't, you know, smoke marijuana inside in like a weed cafe sort of style. And then energy legislation was supposed to come up too, some sort of clean energy bill, but it's unsure whether that will come up because Exelon was supposed to be involved in that, but they're sort of dealing with their own problems. it's unclear too if we'll see anything big come of that.
So going back to the marijuana legislation, we were talking about this a couple weeks ago. So is it clear whether one could smoke marijuana in a restaurant? Is that clear? Because I've heard conflicting opinions about that. I know you cannot smoke a cigarette within a restaurant while dining there. But is that, you said it wasn't the Clean Illinois Indoor Smoking Act was only referenced twice, but do you know if that's the case? Is that something they need to clarify?
I think they definitely intend, so the health advocates do intend to address that and say,
okay,
you absolutely cannot. I spoke with Heather Staines a couple weeks back, and she said that the law was never intended to allow that.
Okay.
I think that the way, again, they passed that law very quickly, and it's over 600 pages. I think there's some things that are maybe not entirely as clear as they could be.
Yeah.
The thing, too, is once you start getting into where you can't smoke marijuana, you start asking the question, well, where can you? So if you live mm-hmm. in an apartment, for instance, the owners of the apartment can dictate, well, you can or cannot smoke there. And so if you can't smoke outside and you can't smoke inside an apartment you're renting and you can't smoke in these, alleged weed cafes that the health advocates say you weren't supposed to be creating anyway, some people who are in favor of recreational marijuana smoking, because again, you can eat it too, but anyways, this question keeps being raised down here, like, well, where are you supposed to be allowed to smoke exactly? Representative Cassidy has said that she was sort of toying with the idea of getting waivers, much like hookah lounges exist, to try to get like weed lounges, maybe. That's not like a restaurant. To address your question, that's definitely not smoking inside of a restaurant.
It's fascinating, how the intention that I recall was what you just stated, that it was to be prohibited in restaurants. But after it passed, there were a couple stories around here indicating that was not clear at all. And so that's probably where this is coming from. It's the lack of clarity. We got about 2 minutes. One thing I probably should ask you is, I know you were the reporter that wrote about a bill that a state rep from Buffalo Grove put forth. It had to do with prohibiting the payment of state monies to go to employees if they have to conduct business in the state where the heartbeat laws passed, the restrictive abortion laws. Have you heard anything further about that, or is that just kind of one he put out there? I haven't heard anything further about it, but maybe you have.
No, I haven't heard anything from that, and other than a lot of pushback that people think it's not. I've heard a lot of people say they're not in favor. His intention was not so much an economic sanction as, the what if of if a pregnant woman goes to a state that she has a miscarriage in, and that state has a law that a criminal investigation has to take place in an instance of a miscarriage. You must protect the Illinois state employee. But a lot of people have said, that's a lot of what ifs.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah.
So,
yeah, as always. So we go down there, next Monday? So we have 3 days, and then 2 weeks off? Is that it? And then November, I don't remember the next, it's the 12th, 13th, 14th, something like that, mid-November. So
yeah.
So we have a lot of, as listeners can discern by now, a lot of unknowns at this stage, which is kind of typical. And this stuff will start to kind of gel maybe later this week. Or not. And then we'll see what happens when we get down there. It's a typical. That's the way these sort of things run. Rebecca, thanks for taking some time this morning. Very informative. And we'll see what actually surfaces next week.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference. And thanks for listening to our show today. Our gratitude goes out to Jim Gioli, who joined us to talk about those Supreme Court cases. Barbara Lyons, who filled us in on that recent report from the Disability Rights Fund, and also Brad Cole, who's going to have his hands full next week in Springfield as they deal with trying to consolidate some of the Illinois state pensions as it relates to firemen and policemen. This is Bob Gilligan. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back on the third Monday in the month of November. So until then, I'll have a happy fall, Halloween, and maybe the Bears can string together 4 victories before we talk again in November. Or not. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week.
Join us every Monday through Friday at this time for Catholic Chicago. You can stream our programs live or listen to past programs by visiting our website, archchicago.org, and clicking on Radio TV. And please connect with Catholic Chicago on social media.